It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Kevin Gavin in for Paul Guggenheimer. Earlier this year, two teachers at Plum High School were charged with having sex with a student. A third teacher was charged with witness intimidation in that case. As part of 90.5 WESA's Life of Learning initiative, we're devoting this hour to the issue of teacher-student fraternization, inappropriate contact, how do school districts inform teachers and staff about such policies, and the line teachers walk between engaging students to want to learn and getting too personally involved. Joining us now on Essential Pittsburgh is Cheryl Shakeshaft, Professor of Education Leadership at Virginia Commonwealth University. Cheryl Shakeshaft, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
I'm glad to be here.
Cheryl, you've been studying the issue of inappropriate teacher-student fraternization for more than 25 years. Can you tell us what changes you might have noticed? The incidents, are they more prevalent, less so, getting more publicity?
Well, we don't know if they're more prevalent because we have no comparable studies. We only have data at one point in time. So it would be useful to have another study to see whether we have more or less. My sense is that we probably have about the same amount of sexual misconduct by teachers and other employees in schools, but that it's being reported more. So we're seeing more reports to the police and to others, and we're seeing more media coverage about it.
And so, therefore, it might seem like there are more such incidents when there might not be.
Correct.
Now, you teach administrators how to deal with situations. What levels? High school, middle school?
All levels. The administrators we teach might be in a preschool, a middle school, a high school, an elementary school, or a university.
All the way down to preschool.
Unfortunately.
So according to your research, I understand that the abuse takes different forms depending on the level of school, whether it is elementary, middle, high school. Would you explain the differences in that abuse?
Well, there are some overlaps, but these general patterns are something like this. In elementary school, the abuser is most likely to be a male, although there are female abusers. And the abuser works very hard to integrate him or herself into the child's family. So at the elementary school, it's very important that the predator is trusted. And by that, I mean trusted by the school. So very often the predator is one of the best teachers in the school. And in fact, they've often won the Best Teacher of the Year award for the state or the city or the school. So they need to be trusted by the school people so that anything they do wouldn't be questioned. They need to be trusted by the child. So the way they work on that is they help the child, they give the child a lot of attention, they give the child presents. They make that child feel really, really special. And they need to be trusted by the family. So generally they meet the family, they meet the parents, they tell the parents that their child is special. One pattern I see in terms of male predator to male student in elementary school is that the male predator calls the mom, who is often a single mother. And this male predator, remember, is an outstanding teacher in the school, the kind of teacher everybody thinks they want their child to have. So this teacher says to the mom, "Listen, your son is an amazing kid. I think he might not have received the attention he deserves. I'd be happy to work with him because he is so bright." And the mom is thrilled because, first of all, all of us want help with our children. But secondly, very often the mom is worried because as a single mother, she's afraid that maybe her child isn't getting the right role models for males. And so this is very, very nice for the mother. And so it moves. So it starts tutoring, starts helping before school, after school, stops by the house. And so what happens is more and more the teacher takes on a role where he or she can, and it's mostly a he, and in this case it's a he, can move the child into other places, take them camping, take them out to movies, take them to ball games. And it's only usually at that point, someplace in this point, where the mother and the father but often the mother and the school and the child are fully on board that this person is a wonderful person, does the actual physical sexual abuse start.
You used a couple of words there I'd like to elaborate on. You said they work at it and they earn the trust. But isn't there also a sort of a natural trust that children tend to have for people in authority, teachers, coaches, clergy, and therefore the abusers take advantage of that trust?
Absolutely. In fact, it's not so hard to get the trust of the child because the child comes to the school already trusting generally and being told to trust. So that's very often just a given. And so what they do is they just bring the child in more to not just trust them, but also to really feel special and to like them.
Is the trust issue also applicable when you move up to, say, the high school level students, or is it a different sort of pattern?
It's a different pattern. In the high school, sometimes the predator knows the students' parents, but often does not and doesn't really work to engage with them. And very often, the elementary predator was a fixated predator, generally has a certain type of child they focus on, maybe a boy, maybe a girl, maybe tall kids, maybe blonde kids. So in the upper middle school and high school, it's more of an opportunistic approach. So if an opportunity arises in which there might be the chance for a sexual encounter, then that adult takes advantage of the opportunity. And so in that, you see a much wider range of targets or victims, you see a much wider range of types of predator, and the patterns are different. They don't contact the parents. They're often not the best teachers. Sometimes they're okay teachers. Sometimes they're good. Sometimes they're terrible, or coaches or whatever else other positions they have. And so what you see is focusing on the child or the teenager and in many ways conducting themselves as if it were a courtship. All of the things you'd see if these were two equal-aged adults interested in each other.
So in this case, they're taking the advantage of students who are maturing, dating, so it's sort of a romantic, I'm using those terms in quotes, sort of grooming?
Exactly. And that is true for both the female and the male predators of both females and males. And so very often these teenagers, they think of themselves as, well, I'm an adult. I can decide what to do. They don't understand the dynamic at the time, usually, of the power that the teacher has. And don't understand the dynamic that a teacher is often more attractive because of the power and being the center of attention of the class than they might be otherwise in just their everyday world. And so we do see this kind of romantic thing, and the teacher or the adult takes advantage of it.
You mentioned both male and female students and both male and female teachers or employees of the school. Do we have a double standard for male and female victims? Are male students less likely to make a complaint?
Male students are less likely to make a complaint, although I do see that changing as students become more aware. But the male student who wants to make a complaint doesn't have a lot of support systems, because if the male student tells his friends that this teacher, if it's a female teacher, has come on to him, the friends often will say, oh, well, great, you're lucky, you get all the luck. And often adults think that all males want sex, no matter who the person is, and therefore, what's the problem? And so we don't really give a lot of support to males who are approached by adults in school. If the predator is a male, then often the student won't say anything because he'll be accused of being homosexual, and that comes with its own set of bullying and teasing and harassment. So males haven't had as much attention in terms of the harm and also identifying what's going on. But that's changing. I'm seeing more and more males reporting.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. Our guest is Cheryl Shakeshaft, professor of education leadership at Virginia Commonwealth University, who has been studying the issue of inappropriate teacher-student fraternization for more than 25 years. Cheryl, let's talk about technology, the role that it plays, such as texting or even sexting. How much of a factor is the technology?
Well, the technology makes it much easier to get to a child without the parent's knowledge. So if the student has his or her own telephone, and of course computer, but a telephone where the texting goes on, or the emails, or the phone calls, very often the parents would have no idea that this is going on, as opposed to when we just had a house with one telephone, or the parents were more likely, if a teacher called, to be able to know what was going on. So it certainly makes it easier to target kids, because there's no way that, or there's very few ways that parents can get into the middle of it and understand what's happening.
Makes it easier to target, but does that same technology make it easier for law enforcement to prove a complaint because of the electronic fingerprints, footprints?
Yes. If it's a text, if it's an email, yes. There are some things that have become harder to document. But yes, it does make it easier to be able to find some kind of trace of what was going on between the two.
So let's talk a little bit about what schools, what school districts are doing, should be doing. Is it up to each school district, do or should states mandate specific policies, including training of personnel regarding fraternization?
Absolutely. About 10% of kids report this happening to them. So that's 4.5 million kids in this country. One in 10 kids, yes. That's a lot. And it happens in all kinds of schools. Don't kid yourself that it wouldn't happen in the school district in the town that you live in. It would. It happens in wealthy schools, in non-wealthy schools, in all-white schools, in racially mixed schools, in all-black schools. It happens in all kinds of schools. It happens in schools for talented kids. It happens in special education schools. It happens every place. So you can't say, oh, this wouldn't come to me. And really the major ways of prevention are, one, having good and specific policies about the expectations for the interactions between adults and students in schools. And while a policy won't necessarily stop it, it's a document that lets everyone know what's expected and what will happen if you violate those expectations. Secondly, you have to teach people. And by that, I don't mean just say, read the policy book. That's not teaching. That's just providing some information if someone cares to use it. And that tends to be the extent of the training in most districts. You know, at the beginning of school, they pass out the teacher handbook. They say, I'm just going to go down. You know, there's a section on sexual harassment. There's a section on interactions with kids. And look, there's a new section on turning in textbooks. And that's it. And they say, then read it. Well, that doesn't get us any place, really. We need to really give teachers and adults examples. We need them to understand what will happen. And we need to make sure that the teachers who don't sexually abuse know what they're seeing when someone else is grooming a child or bringing children in early in the morning or late in the afternoon with the doors closed. So it's a matter of not just teaching people what's expected and what's not expected, but also letting people know that they are required by law, if they think something might be going on with an adult in the school and a student, to report it.
They are required reporters.
That's right. And so what we found is that while most teachers understand the mandated reporting laws when it concerns someone outside of the school, they don't really understand, or they're more reluctant to follow the mandated reporting laws when something's happening inside the school.
So you mentioned have specific policies, what's expected. Teach the employees, including teachers, not just hand them out materials. Let people know about the requirements of mandated reporting. So from your research, how high of a priority is it for school districts to enforce those policies?
Well, for most districts, it's not a very high priority. And the reason it's not is because they figure, okay, 1 in 10 kids, maybe that's a couple of kids in my district, maybe it'll never happen. I think it's important. I don't want kids to be sexually abused, but I have state tests to take care of. I have kids in poverty. I have all sorts of other issues that come before this. And it's legitimate for them to worry about all the other things as well. But what happens is that the kind of training that needs to be done goes down on the list.
I want to go back to your materials for teachers and teaching them. What about materials and informing, instructing, having two-way conversations with parents at the beginning of a school year or whatever? What about that sort of openness?
Yes, and I should have said when I talk about training, I think there should be training focused at adults who work in the school, training focused on the kids to let the kids know that it's not okay for a teacher to be flirting with you. Even if you like it, it's not okay. It's against the law for teacher-student sex. So students and then parents, these are the things you should pay attention to. We hope that nothing will ever happen, but we know nationwide 1 in 10 children are targeted. So these are the things you need to know about it.
What about protecting teachers against, it can happen, it has happened. You mentioned closed doors. Well, teachers are not supposed to have closed doors with one student. They're supposed to have other adult witnesses. So how do you also protect teachers from inaccurate and just plain wrong accusations?
The best way to protect teachers is to first do good supervision so you know what your teachers are doing, so you have a sense of that. You're in the halls if you're the principal. You're in the halls before school, after school. You walk into classes. You know what's happening. But the second way to protect teachers is to make sure that good investigation is done. And that's not necessarily something that the school does, but trained investigators know how to determine, in most cases, whether or not what a child says is true or not true. We actually find a very low percentage of children in schools who make up something about the teacher. There are some, but it's a very low percentage.
Let's talk about the investigation and transparency. How important is it not just to let the parents of the alleged victim know what's going on, but let's face it, parents of other students in a school, in a district, they're going to hear about allegations. How important is that transparency, that openness to all parents in the district, in the school?
Kids and parents tend to believe that the school district hasn't done anything about a complaint because they don't hear about the results. And so even when a school district is doing everything they should, they often, the parents and kids don't hear about it, and then they don't trust the administration. So often when a parent makes a complaint for their child, they don't get any feedback about what's going on, and they should. You can give feedback. You can let the community know without divulging names, without violating privacy. And if someone is arrested, that needs to be put out by the school, and very often it's not. In the schools that I study, often the other administrators don't even know what the person did or what the person was charged with doing unless they see the criminal complaint in the newspaper. In almost every case I've studied, the victim leaves the school, and the school has done nothing to make their stay there better.
Sometimes I would think that a student feels more comfortable just plain talking with a teacher, opening up to a teacher. Should the teacher refer the student to a school counselor, or isn't that situation just as fraught with potential problems?
Well, it may be fraught with potential problems, but school counselors are trained to counsel. So it depends on what the kid is talking to the teacher about. Remember, the teacher is really there for academic purposes. And sure, a kid might say, I'm having a really hard time at home, and that's why I didn't get my homework in. And the teacher can be sympathetic, but that's really an indication for the teacher that this child needs to talk with somebody else who's trained to deal with the kinds of things they're going to talk about. And so turning it back to the academics and saying, I want to help you get an appointment with the counselor so you can talk about this, is really the role of the teacher. And many people say, well, you know, I want my students to trust me and I want them to know that I'm there for them. And you can do that by referring them and then checking up on them to make sure they're okay. You know, how you doing? I hope you're okay. We forget that there's many ways to help kids trust the teacher. And one of the best ways to help them trust them is to focus on their academics and let them know that you care about how they're doing in school and you care about helping them.
Finally, Cheryl, if you would, what is your advice for all parties concerned?
For all parties concerned, I would say if you're going to meet with one-on-one with a student, do it in a public place, the library, out in the halls, a place where you can talk privately with the student, but it's a public place. Secondly, remember that students are kids. They're not adults. They're not equal to you. And so you can't assume that because a child says to you, I'd like to go to bed with you, that it's okay. It's not. And I'd say to all teachers and all adults in school, keep your eyes open. If you see something that looks fishy, report it. If you see something that concerns you, report it. In so many cases that I've been in schools with teachers, they'll say to me after the person's gone to jail, you know, I always felt funny about that, but, you know, I didn't want to say anything in case I ruined a person's career, a good teacher's career. I've never heard a teacher say, you know, I really felt funny about that, so I reported it because I didn't want to ruin a kid's life. And that's really what we're talking about.
Cheryl Shakeshaft is a professor of education leadership at Virginia Commonwealth University. Cheryl, thanks so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Cheryl Shakeshaft is a professor of education leadership at Virginia Commonwealth University. Coming up, the legal requirements of school districts in training teachers regarding inappropriate contact and investigating allegations of misconduct.
Because this is a difficult problem to control, school districts are developing policies that deal with employee conduct.
We'll speak with Pittsburgh Public Schools solicitor Ira Weiss. That's when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA.